Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
All right, so songbirds are finishing up breeding, and you know, I sent you a picture of my cute little baby catbirds. I was weeding, and I was pulling some bindweed off of an azalea bush, and a catbird, you know, went out and went, "What's going on over here?" And I saw the little nest with the eggs a couple weeks ago, and I believe they fledged Sunday morning because I saw them on Saturday, and now they're gone. But I can hear that. I hear mom, and I've heard them, but I haven't seen them. Oh, did you hit mute? Why don't I hear you?
You can hear me now?
I can hear you now.
I was just about to sign out and sign back in again, which often fixes that problem. It's just like being in a meeting, as always happens to somebody.
Yeah. So the songbirds, yeah, they're
yeah. Cool. I was fawning over your adorbs, baby catbirds.
Adorable.
Yeah, it's the end of the season, but you know, birds are working hard. They take advantage of the full breeding season to get out as many chicks as they can. These local birds will have multiple broods. I'm sure those catbirds had fledged other chicks earlier in the season. Bluebirds do multiple broods. I'm not on the Cape right now. I'm up near the New Hampshire border at an undisclosed location digging out for my vacation. You know, you have to kind of hide that first day back from vacation so you can catch up on things. But I'm up in near Lowell, up near the New Hampshire border here, and there's some house wrens who are very, very busy, and they're like right next to the deck. And so you can see how hard these parents are working to feed these pretty old chicks. You know, they're old, they're sticking their faces out. They're very hungry. And you're just watching where the parents go. They go kind of back into the woods, into this wet thicket a little bit to find stuff. And they're foraging around the garden and they're feeding them like, it seems like once a minute. I mean, it's unbelievable how hard it is that 2 week period where songbirds are feeding their chicks and getting them big enough to the point where they can get out of the nest and survive. It's just amazing to watch these little songbirds work so hard, and they know how to find the bugs. But other than that, it's incredibly quiet right now. Right, most things are done. Things have fledged and they're kind of dispersing around. But we've been here a few mornings. And it's so quiet that birds are not singing. They're around, you know, there are different woodpeckers around and the house wrens, and there's some catbirds around that are feeding in a dogwood thicket here that I'm very jealous of, where the fruits are just ripening. There's some certain dogwood shrubs that catbirds and other birds just love. We have some at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary, silky dogwood and gray dogwood. And so they're just chowing on those. But one thing here that lets me know I'm not on the Cape is pileated woodpeckers.
Oh.
And I've been hearing them since yesterday afternoon and then this morning again. They have not colonized the Cape yet. I expect them to. There's certainly suitable woods on the upper and mid Cape. I expect it to happen one of these days, but we just, you know, they like kind of bigger forests, and they're just not on the Cape yet. These big, spectacular crow-sized woodpeckers.
Yeah,
one of the things I like to see when I come up here, you know, I like birds. I have a map of birds and where they are and where they aren't, and it's one of those things that lets me know I'm not on the Cape. Oh, yeah. Pileated woodpecker. I'm not at home anymore. but overall, very quiet for songbirds. But you know, maybe you have some that are just finishing up in your yard, getting out that last brood of chicks. Goldfinches are probably still working hard because they start so late. They like to be feeding their chicks now on seeds because they're one of the few birds that they don't even feed insects to their chicks. They're like truly granivorous, right? Mm. They're pretty much just eating seeds. Two hummingbirds just went by. They're pretty much just eating seeds and flowers and leaves. You know, they're like herbivorous with a strong focus on seeds. And that's pretty unusual. I mean, almost all birds, even ones that you might think are a seed eater, like a cardinal, you know, they're mostly eating insects and feeding insects to their babies and the breeding.
Protein, right? They need the protein.
Exactly. Yeah. But goldfinches are different. And so they wait till the late summer when there are more of the, you know, flowers have gone to seed so they can feed that to their chicks. But other than that, it's winding down. It feels quiet. It's got that late summer feel. There's back to school ads and, you know,
are you getting
that
more than back to school? Halloween stuff is out already. It's crazy.
That's ridiculous.
We're going to see Christmas before you know it. All right. Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from Martha's Vineyard. Hi, Janet.
Hi, I'm not talking about birds now. I want to talk about mammals,
Okay.
the bats that are in my yard.
Bats, okay.
And it's wonderful. I can go out and sit on the mounting block for my horse, and just when it gets almost completely dark, they come out and they go in a circle. There's like three or four of them, and they keep going, and I guess they're getting insects up there.
Right.
And I don't know where they live because they're not in my barn or my house yet.
That you know of.
Yeah, I
Well, I
know.
had one years ago. I had one get in my house through a screen and flew across my face.
Oh, dear.
And well, I have a night light, and I thought it was a moth first, and then I realized it wasn't. I tried to get it out. I couldn't, and I wasn't about to call my friend Joan, who was animal control at midnight, so I said, well, it'll have to stay here till tomorrow morning. She came and got it with a crab net and put it
Oh,
outside.
funny. Yeah, you don't
A
want them in
crab
the
net.
house, but that's good that we're seeing because we, and Mark, I'm sure you know this, the white nose syndrome the bats have been experiencing has been kind of distressing for the bat community.
Yeah, it's just nice to hear that anyone is seeing bats. I mean, we just need them, and they have suffered one of the greatest, most catastrophic wildlife declines we've ever seen, really. That's not an exaggeration. Particularly the little brown bat, that was sort of the default bat for our childhood. You know, you just see bats around, and I remember as a kid, we would throw little rocks up to watch them come down after them. But white nose syndrome has hammered the little brown bats and other small bats that winter communally in caves. And we know from old research that Cape Cod bats actually fly north for the winters. Weird as that seems, they fly north to find caves with suitable temperature and humidity in places like New Hampshire and Western Mass and New York. There's some old Cape Cod-based research that elucidated this interesting factoid. And they're just packed in shoulder to shoulder. You can imagine the epidemiology of that when this new fungus came in from European caves and just is just destroying them. It saps their reserves during the winter. They get irritated. They get up. They fly around when they shouldn't be. And so it's a problem. And I just don't see bats too much anymore. I think there's some under the rake boards of my neighbor's house. I don't tell them in case they're squeamish.
Oh yeah, but Janet, you're lucky. I'm jealous. I think bats get a bad rap sometimes, but they're
Yeah, well, it said in one of my books that they sometimes live in trees in the summer here.
Oh, really? Huh.
I
Oh,
have a lot of
absolutely.
trees.
Yeah. Right. And so there are different species of bats. There are there are three species of tree bat, four really species of tree bats. There's the northern long-eared bat, which has been federally listed. And the other bats, little brown bat, is state endangered. That's happened in the last 10 years or so,
Well,
because
these
of
are very
white nose
small. These are
syndrome.
not large. They look
They're
very
all
small.
small. We don't have they're all small. We don't have big bats in, temperate North America, but yeah, and it's hard to tell the difference between species, but there are some somewhat larger tree roosting species that actually migrate south for the winter, like birds do, like eastern red bat, hoary bat, silver-haired bat. But typically, we're seeing big brown bats as what's left because they don't go to the caves as much. They're more likely to winter locally. And then there's the northern long-eared bats, which are federally listed as well. And different people have been studying those on the Cape and on Martha's Vineyard. Avoid white nose syndrome by wintering locally. Can you still hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah, you went out for a second there. I don't know. Maybe you got a loose wire or something. I don't know. But Janice, like, because they also eat the mosquitoes. You want to have some bats in your yard. All right. I think you're going out again there, Mark. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mark, you mentioned a couple of hummingbirds flying by you there. It's a good time, right, to be watching the hummingbirds?
It is. This is peak time, really, because the young ones have fledged and they're out and they're hungry, and so they're swarming feeders. You might see, two or three at a time, as I have been here. And we have them for another month, more really. It seems like they stay closer to October 1st, every year. And I typically will see my last ones in early October, but mid-September has always been that's when the hummingbirds leave. And so we've got at least another month to enjoy them. And so if you do feeders, get those out, keep them clean. Or if you do the, flowers, there's lots of things you can get that keep them coming, like firecracker plant and black and blue salvia, things like that. If you do annuals, lots of perennials too. But yeah, it's just a fun time of year to watch all the, and you can kind of tell the young ones, they're a little dopier than the adults. They fly a little slower. They're a little more tentative landing on things. But they're just learning how to be hummingbirds. And here they've been getting chased away by yellow jackets, which is funny because they're not afraid of any bird. They'll any bigger bird, they just harass mercilessly, chase. But they don't seem to like the yellow jackets.
Do the yellow jackets sting them?
I don't imagine they could catch one.
I know they're so fast.
They seem to be bothered by them. They don't want to get harassed by the yellow jackets, so they take off.
Interesting. All right, so shorebird migration is peaking right now, right?
Yes. It's really the best time of the year for that here on the Cape. And people come here specifically for that and to go out to Race Point and look at seabirds and get out on the boats, get out on whale watch boats, because everything is really happening at once with seabirds and shorebirds and wading birds. It's the post-breeding period, terns are staging. We might talk about that later. But for shorebirds, all of these Arctic nesting species, we know about local nesting species, piping plovers, American oyster catchers, and willets, but that's about it. A couple others, spotted sandpipers. But for the most part, the shorebirds that we see on Cape Cod are ones that nested up in the Arctic tundra, some Arctic coastal tundra somewhere in northern Alaska or Canada. And they're on their way south to wherever, lots of different places. Some winter here, sanderlings, dunlins, they winter here. And then other species will go as far as the other end of South America. Things like godwits and red knots will go all the way to Patagonia, the southern tip of South America. It's just remarkable. And so, and we're part of that, right? We're a stop on that journey, and there might be 30 species that come through here over the course of a summer, including some rare things. You might expect 10 or 12 at a really good shorebirding day, 10 or 12 species out there, maybe 8. But it's worth paying attention to them and spending some time learning them. I think people get intimidated by them. Some of them are truly little brown jobs, right? Semi-palmated sandpiper versus least sandpiper. But there are plenty of resources, and with good looks, you can do it. Looking at like leg color and overall color and the bill and things like that, it's worth doing. And just learning a little bit of their stories, which are incredible,
I
the
kind of
distances they cover.
I feel like the sandpipers are like the sparrows. I have a hard time telling them apart.
Yeah, some of them are. I mean, others are more distinctive. But yes, the peeps, right? The little, the kind of little grayish and brownish sandpipers. But they have different habits. Like least sandpipers are not out on the flats in big flocks. If you see a big flock of little gray sandpipers out on the flats, they're not least sandpipers. They're semi-palmated. The least sandpipers like to hang out back in the marshes more, either singly or like twos and threes and little groups. And so, there are ways with experience that you can tell these things apart. And then interesting things show up, like when bird or red-necked phalarope, just it's more of an ocean-going sandpiper, which is interesting in and of itself, but it's sort of flew in off the ocean up at Balsan Beach in Truro and just hung out and stayed overnight in a little pond there. And some birders were able to go see that. And so we're all, our antennae are up for rare shorebirds at this time of year. Will somebody find a curlew sandpiper from Eurasia? Will somebody find a little stint or a redneck stint? Also, these Eurasian shorebirds that sometimes turn up, because when you're going from the top of the planet to the middle parts of the planet, it doesn't take that much of a navigation error to end up in a very wrong place, right? You just like You turned a little bit too far to the right when you started flying, and instead of ending up in West Africa, you ended up in Cape Cod, right? And so that happens. And so that's what birders, a lot of birders are doing right now. They're trying to get the parts of Monomoy if they can. It's just harder than it used to be, but you can still get out to some of the old places. What's left of
What's
South Beach?
left of it,
South
yeah,
Beach and
right.
Chatham used to be a big, long barrier beach, and now it's sort of a stub attached to the north end of South Monomoy. And everybody's always asking, how do I get out there? How do we get out there? But there are plenty of other places that are not, don't involve boating. You go to
Yeah,
Chapin
Race
Beach in
Point.
Dennis.
Yeah, go to Race Point.
Grays Point, it does have some shorebirds. That's more of a seabirding place, but it has both. I mean, there are
Yeah.
interesting shorebirds there as well. People are getting whimbrels and all white-rumped sandpipers and all kinds of other things there. And why people are going there and making that trek, walking 2 miles in soft sand down the beach out to the actual race where the deep water comes in, is to see seabirds, right? And the whale watches are always a good thing to do, but they haven't been super birdy this year, the whale watches. And so, you could go to Race Point and see hopefully see the four species of shearwater and see Wilson storm petrels, the things you would normally see out in the boat, and then maybe see any number of other rare things. Terns are staging there. You might see Arctic tern. People have seen, you see black tern there. And so
Puffin,
people really,
somebody saw a puffin.
somebody saw a puffin, and that's pretty unusual in summer. I mean, occasionally someone sees a puffin during a storm later, like more towards winter, but a summer puffin is really unusual. But there it was. He had a photo of it. This guy Ted Bradford, who goes out there all the time. So that was a real surprise for people. And the Jaegers are coming. Birders love the Jaegers. These are really athletic kind of bullies. They come and they bully the terns and the small gulls and even the big gulls sometimes to steal fish from them. And that's a real show where you can just go out there with your popcorn and sit and watch the parasitic Jaegers harassing the terns. Just incredible feats of birdie athleticism, just these beak to tail pursuits, like zip straight up, and then it's like fighter pilots, but
Yeah, fun to watch,
the
yeah.
maneuvers are more difficult. And so that's happening now. There's been some long-tailed Jaegers out there, which I think we used to miss them a lot before everybody had really good digital cameras like now. I think we used to miss the rare long-tailed Jaegers, which are one of the three species of Jaegers that nest up in the Arctic. But now people are snapping photos of everything, looking at them, and realizing, hey, those were long-tailed Jaegers. And
Yeah.
so people get more of those now. It's just a lot of fun out there this
Yeah.
time of year.
I talked to Evan, giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Evan.
Hello. I had the wonderful opportunity about 3 weeks ago. I was playing screech owl sounds on my Bluetooth speaker and had a little screech owl land on. I have a solar lantern right on my deck, as well as two others on my chimney.
Wow.
But that was 3 weeks ago. But I got a great picture of the little creature. Wonderful.
I'll bet.
As well as the two on the chimney. It's amazing how big their white wingspan is for the size of the bird, though.
Right. It's often hard to judge the size of owls because of when you see them. It just looks like a big moth because it's kind of dark. But they are very, as all birders know, they are very, very responsive, they being screech owls, to playback or any kind of poor imitation. It doesn't have to be a good imitation of their call,
Right.
I mean, I've learned to
But
do that, but you
this
don't even
one
have to
land
do the
this one
tremolo part.
right, this one
And
landed within 7 feet of me and
that's
sat on the
amazing. And they will come in and just kind of sit there trying to figure things out. But that's an unusually intimate experience that
Yeah.
you had with them. So that's very cool. And yet, like all other birds, the young ones are out, which is why you had three or four or whatever. They typically get vocal again in August, but I haven't been hearing that. Somehow this year, I have not had the typical uptick in screech owls calling. I don't know what other people are hearing, but it's generally every August, sometimes even late July, they really pick up and start calling. And I don't know if it's the young birds learning how to call that explains that, or if for some reason the adults get vocal again. It's probably the young birds. But Yeah. I don't know if anybody else is hearing them.
Evan, thanks for sharing. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Stephen wrote, longtime Truro resident and Audubon supporter, and he was hoping you might help identify a bird that he couldn't find in Sibley or iBird Pro. And sent you some photos of that, Mark.
Yeah, this was cool. You never know what to expect when people are sending you a mystery bird. Usually it's just something common or, but this was, and this, it was something I've never, a plumage and age of a bird, a local bird that I had just never seen. It was a juvenile, like a recent fledgling black-billed cuckoo from up in Truro. And, you know, I did bird surveys all through the National Seashore for 3 years in grad school and been birding for, I don't know, 40 something years at this point, and I've never seen a fledgling black-billed cuckoo. They're just not, they're hard to find, but out in Truro in the National Seashore woods, and there's just a lot of habitat out there, and both species of cuckoos are out there. There was just, and they were really nice photos. This was somebody who was a good photographer, so that was just cool to see. It turned out they were from last June, and so he told me that after the fact, but just something cool to see that's out there that, you know, is a rare enough sight that I've never seen it in all my years of obsessively looking at birds.
Yeah, fun to get stuff
baby
like that.
Cuckoos, yeah. Baby cuckoos.
A little while back there, you mentioned tern staging, and I'm thinking staging shorebirds and seabirds. What does that mean? Explain what staging is and why that's important.
All the world's a stage for the terns right now. Well, not all the world. They have... They have certain stages they prefer, like Race Point, Hatches Harbor, the tips of barrier beaches, where they're sort of away from people. You know, they're different, the north and south tips of Nauset Beach, places like that, islands. And so after the breeding season, you know, there are tens of thousands of terns on Monomoy and then other places in the region. And the Cape, we know from studies of color-banded birds that birds from Canada to New York, whether they have to fly north or south to get here, they get here. And these terns are coming here. Even so, a tern from Long Island Sound is coming north to stage and feed on Cape Cod before it heads to, you know, Brazil. And so that says something about our importance, the importance of our waters, our beaches, for them to rest and to feed. You know, same, they're feeding on the same things that the whales are here to feed on, the sand eels and other little bait fish, little bunker, little menhaden. And our waters are just really important to terns from beyond Cape Cod, beyond Massachusetts, really. And that was an interesting finding from the studies of these terns. And one of the reasons we put bans on things is, you know, you learn things. And so, you know, things people can do, you know, you always get people running their dogs through the flocks and driving through them and all that kind of thing. They're subject to a lot of disturbance, but it is important for them to rest. It's good for people to keep that in mind. Give them a break. There's signs out there. I think the National Seashore had some signs. You know, give them a break. The shorebirds and seabirds are having to fly maybe nonstop from here to South America, and that takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of building up of fat reserves, and it's harder to do that if they're getting flushed constantly by your dog or cars or your joggers and whatever. So just if you could take a wide berth around these staging flocks of terns and shorebirds, that helps them. And so for terns, you're mostly going to be seeing common terns, which are the species that nest by the thousands on Monomoy, but also roseate terns, which are kind of a paler, slightly slimmer, thinner build version of a common tern that's federally endangered. That's a special bird that we have here that nests mainly in Buzzards Bay on a couple of islands, like 50% of the Northwest Atlantic population nests on those two islands or something close to it. But they're staging now. They're mixed in with the common terns. Forster's terns are coming from I don't know where, either the Midwest or somewhere south. They don't breed here. And so that's another example of birds coming here, even if it doesn't necessarily make sense relative to where they spend the winter, because of the resources Cape Cod offers to these terns. We really live in a special place. and they agree. And so, yeah, just sorting through terns can be challenging, but the forester's terns are easy to pick out. They have these two black eyes, almost like a raccoon mask. They look a lot different than the other terns. Lease terns are still around. They'll be gone by mid-September. They're gone. They migrate really early down to South American waters. They're the little ones that nest on the beaches here. You might see a black tern. They're cool. That's a freshwater tern that would be coming down from, I don't know, Canada or the Finger Lakes of New York or something like that. They nest in some big freshwater marsh, but they come to the ocean in migration. And Buzzards Bay can be full of them sometimes, but you might see one or two other places. And so, yeah, get to know your terns too. Yeah. Know all the birds. Basically, what I'm saying. Learn all the birds.
It was interesting when you mentioned the woodpeckers earlier. Just even knowing the calls, which it can take a while to learn that, but you don't always see them, but sometimes you can hear them if you know what you're listening to.
Yes, when I was younger, I feel like I struggled with downy versus hairy woodpecker.
Yeah.
Like how do you tell the difference in the call even? But it's actually straightforward once I figured it out. And when I give workshops, it's just downy goes down, like their call goes down in pitch. It goes, and the hairy woodpecker stays all on one pitch. And it sounds like a bigger, huskier bird if you hear them right next to each other. And it's just it's all on one pitch. So downy goes down. That's all you need to know to tell those two apart. But yeah, there are little tricks that, you pick up over time. But yes, they sound very different. Red-bellied sounds, doesn't sound like the others.
Yeah.
Flickers sound very different than everybody else. So, and everyone's using Merlin now. So I think more and more people are picking up on this stuff.
Yeah. I know that you keep an eye on the piping plover population. What's going on with those little guys? Did we have a good season?
Good question. I wasn't able to do all of the meeting that we had last week of all the cooperators from all the New England states, at least. Ours had a pretty good year. The ones I oversee from like North Truro down to Chatham, I don't monitor most of the Chatham ones, but we had pretty good productivity in terms of the number of chicks produced. Mostly late in the season. We had a lot of nest loss early in the season to predators and overwash, which are the two big things that affect piping plover's ability to produce chicks. Do the nests get washed out by storms or eaten by crows and coyotes and foxes? But they did well. The second wave of nesting after all the predation did pretty well in our case. But it's just interesting to watch. Every season's a little different. It's generally the same things that are the main factors, but sometimes the predators give you a break. Like I manage Tern Island in Chatham, this little island right off the fish pier there. And we have this pattern where the coyotes are there in the spring. And we're like, oh no, what's going to happen? We're not going to produce any, because there's a tern colony there, oyster catchers nest there, piping plovers nest there. And so we worry about the coyotes and then they leave. For some reason, the coyotes go somewhere else. And maybe they'll come back in late summer, but after they've been able to fledge chicks. And that's been a pattern for several years, which is great. And so we were able to produce a lot of plover chicks, a lot of lease tern chicks, and one oyster catcher chick. They're fun to watch.
Yeah, they're fun.
It was a good season, at least for us on the Outer Cape, but you have to look at the whole state.
Right.
And I did not see the statewide estimate.
Right. And we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Carol in Falmouth writes, the pace of grape jelly consumption from the shingle propped on my deck has gone from 3 refills a day to 1 every other day. It still draws many, many catbirds, many feisty female orioles, and an occasional male. Occasionally inquisitive sparrows visit, and one big bossy blue jay who apparently felt it was beneath his or her dignity to return. Why did most of the male orioles disappear? And do any birds eat those pesky yellow jackets that guard the jelly ferociously during warmer hours of the day?
Yeah, I don't think much is eating the yellow jackets. there are different bird species around the world that specialize in stinging insects. Summer tanagers are one of them, but they mainly nest south of here and turn up as a rare bird now and again. but I've seen scarlet tanager eating wasps in my neighborhood. But anyway, if they can catch them right, they can get them. But I have not seen anybody like trying to pick them off of the jelly feeders and hummingbird feeders they're always on. The male orioles, it may be more that the adults are leaving. And so it's true in a lot of birds that the adults will migrate first. They're sort of like, you're on your own, kids. And this is true of the Arctic nesting shorebirds. They get basically abandoned by the adults. The female adult leaves first, and then the male. And they head south without the kids, right? And so the kids have to find their own way to Central South America, whatever it is. And that's true of the songbirds, too. And so the males are the easiest to recognize as adults, and the females just kind of look like the young birds. So you might not have noticed that the females left, too. So there are a lot of juveniles around. But, you know, increasingly, some orioles are staying on the Cape for the winter, and there are people who figure that out, and they're leaving their jelly feeders up. And occasionally you do get adult males who will overwinter, but mostly they leave. Adult mm-hmm. birds are more serious about migration than the young birds, and they just kind of beeline. I think they learned the first time how difficult migration is. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, this is true of ospreys, and, you know, we just know this from tracking studies that young birds are dopey and wander around just like people, and then the adult birds are more serious, like, let's get in the car and go, come on. We got to beat the traffic. Birds are just like people in that regard, and that the adults are just like, I'm getting to Costa Rica, you know, I'm beating the traffic. And exactly. The young birds are like, I'm gonna stay at this jelly feeder.
Why would we
see what's
now?
Up here. Yeah. I'm gonna go north a little bit and find myself, you know.
All right. Linda's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I have two questions. Just listening to the oriole conversation, I mean, I just have catbirds that just dominate my oriole feeder. Every now and then there'll be an oriole, but the catbirds are just on it all the time, and there doesn't seem to be any way to deter them. And also my question is about the turkeys. We had a person in our neighborhood who was putting out corn and food because he loved seeing the wildlife. And so these turkeys have come and are just everywhere. Now they're in our trees all night long, and of course leaving a terrific mess all over the driveway. Is there any deterrent for the wild turkeys, and what's the status of them? You know, supposedly they were endangered, and now they're, you know, just a total nuisance.
They're so, everywhere, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, it's all a matter of perspective. They were never endangered. They were just literally entirely gone from the state. And then they were reintroduced. I don't think they ever listed them under the State Endangered Species Act. They just went ahead and did the recovery, you know, with the support of hunters. It's ultimately, you know, hunters drive the reintroduction of turkeys to all the different places. I was involved in a reintroduction in South Florida in Everglades National Park. They had to reintroduce turkeys. It was the turkey hunters that were bankrolling that. But yeah, they were reintroduced to the Cape in 93 from stock from Western Mass and New York, upstate New York. And yeah, they've done very well, and people feed them, and the deterrent is difficult because if it's your neighbor that's feeding them, you can't control your neighbor's behavior, and they're just going to do what they want because they're big birds. And so that's a tough one.
Yeah.
You know, they come through my neighborhood, and I've seen, you know, the female comes through with the chicks, and they're not a nuisance. They kind of keep going. Sometimes you see them, sometimes they don't. But yeah, if you've got the neighbor that's feeding them, they're going to camp out, and then people get annoyed because they dig things up. They dig up gardens and things like that. I know Vern was never a fan of the turkeys, but they're cool. You know, if they behave themselves and they just come through, they're cool to see. It's fun to see the little poults. Mm. And I am always shocked at how they can fly when they're little. Oh. Typically, I would expect them not to, like, you know, baby birds, songbirds can't fly until they're pretty much adult size and they grow in the adult looking feathers. But these fuzzy little poults, I'm like, oh, those are too young to fly. And then they just zip up and over a fence. And I'm like, what? How did that happen? Oh, boy. Very cute. I have to check. Oh, we've got a, is that a giant swallowtail? Oh, I've got a rare butterfly sighting in real time. It's a giant swallowtail.
Wow.
Which is a southern, it's a big spectacular swallowtail that lays its eggs on citrus, pretty sure.
Oh.
I think it's a citrus pest in Florida, but it's rare up here, and they've been making inroads like a lot of southern things. It's just visiting my mother-in-law's butterfly bush right now.
There you go.
And next to it is a Zabulon skipper. Weren't we going to talk about butterflies?
We are going to talk about butterflies, but I got a couple.
Is this a good segue?
No, let's get a couple phone calls in, and then we'll talk about butterflies. All right. Joan is calling from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. I had a weasel on my deck Sunday morning.
Ooh.
Oh, I'm so jealous. I've been dying for a yard weasel. And I don't mean the garden weasel tool that you can buy on, you know.
I was washing the breakfast dishes. I looked out the window, and I went, is that a little red squirrel? And I'm going, no, that's not a little red squirrel. That's a weasel. I've never seen one here on the Cape before. But
yeah, they're around, but you sure don't see them much. I saw one recently in East Ham just quickly crossing a road. Somebody I know on the North Shore, a birder. Oh, man. Mindy, can I be dismissed early to go take pictures of this butterfly?
No.
Darn it.
It'll still be there. You got 15 minutes, yeah.
Yeah. But weasels are awesome. And, you know, that's natural pest control. I mean, you know, they're eating rodents. They're eating rabbits. They're eating these pesky eastern cottontails that are eating everybody's garden that shouldn't be in New England. They're not native to New England.
I want a weasel in my yard.
Everybody should want a weasel. I mean, in the old days, I hear stories from the old Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary, you know, back before there was a wild care, back before there was IFAW and all these things, you know, Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary was sort of everything. They were rescuing seals. They were rehabbing wildlife. And apparently they raised a weasel that had been orphaned, and it eventually became a nuisance, and it would like come up through the floorboards of the old building and like bite someone on the ankle and then run away. So they're like, you know, they're feisty little predators, and they can fit through just about anything. But yeah, a friend of mine up on the North Shore, it had one that was like on his deck taunting his cat.
I think you just
got this video of the cat looking out the window, and the weasel just keeps, it was pop goes the weasel, it would like pop its head up. I love them. They're just such fun little animals. I was in Plymouth the other day. I was driving, and I saw what looked like a vole cross the road, and I look back in the rearview mirror, and then there was a mink chasing it.
Oh, wow.
I just missed getting a good look at this mink chasing the vole. It was right along a river, which is, you know, minks like to be. And that's a weasel, basically. It's just like a darker weasel that likes water more.
Yeah. But, Joan, thanks for sharing. That's a great story. All right, Eric is calling from Sandwich. Hi, Eric.
Good morning, Mindy. Good morning, Mark.
Morning.
Good morning. Typically, this time of year, I see what I believe to be swallows kind of congregating over my house in South Sandwich. And they are flying, and they're not just passing by, but they seem to be feeding. But they're at least twice as high as our trees. And I'm curious if these are indeed swallows or if there's some other swallow-like bird. And if they are they feeding that high up? Is there enough forage up there for them to be feeding? Okay. And it just seems to be very common in August.
Yes.
The way air currents are.
Well, it just, so gulls do it too. And so one of the things that happens at this time of year and other times of year is the ant colonies send out the winged alates. And so the ants grow wings and they fly and they swarm out of the colonies. And you can see laughing gulls and ring-billed gulls snapping them out of the air like big swallows. And the swallows certainly take advantage of that. But swallows in general, you know about plankton in the oceans, right? I mean, people get this idea that they're just little things that we can't always see that are just like in the water, all throughout the water. That is the base of the food chain. But I learned this term a few years ago, aerial plankton. And so there are all kinds of insects up in the air that we're not aware of. And that even includes things like ballooning spiders. It sounds like someone's nightmare. There are spiders everywhere. They're in the air all around you. Someone's hiding under their bed right now, learning that for the first time. But, you know, that's why we need the birds. They're up there. And so we have the purple martin colony at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary and also at Long Pastures Mass Audubon Sanctuary. And they're fun to watch. And they are up foraging quite high. And then the kites. We talked about the kites so much, swallowtail kites and Mississippi kites, and they're like big swallows, particularly the Mississippi kites. They're up high, and you can watch them because they're big. And that one that I had over my house, this Mississippi kite, you could see it grabbing things with its feet up on the wing and then munching on it. Hmm. And they like dragonflies. A lot of birds will pick, like bigger birds, migrating falcons even, will pick dragonflies out of the air. That's a lot of what the kites do. The martins are up eating dragonflies, and the dragonflies are up there eating smaller insects. And so they're up there. There's this aerial plankton, and people are worried about it. You know, you hear about the insect apocalypse, and there's a lot of concern for aerial insectivores, the swallows, the swifts, these birds that depend on these insects that are invisible up high in the sky above us. And so, yeah, there is some reason they're there. You know, we need them eating those bugs, but we also worry, are there enough bugs to support these and other birds and other things that depend on bugs right now?
Mm. Eric, thanks for the call.
It seems like a very distinct, I was just going to say, it seems like a very distinct habitat. And because I never see swallows down low near my property, it's always
okay
up high.
Yeah, they're down low other places. And the tree swallows that are the famous swarming swallow of summer, this is the time of year where there's this really cool phenomenon where tree swallows, which are the ones that nest in bluebird boxes and hollow trees, they mass in the dunes where they eat the insects that are produced by the wetlands and other plants around, you know, around these dune systems and barrier beach systems. But they also eat the bayberries, particularly as it gets later into the fall before they head south to, you know, Florida or the Carolinas or Caribbean. They don't go very far, but they're down low eating bayberries sometimes. And they're certainly down low eating insects along the surfaces of ponds. That's a classic way to watch swallows feeding in a more accessible way is the surface of a pond where there are often hatches of things that they're just skimming right above the surface of the pond. And there were tree swallows doing that at Gull Pond in Wellfleet into January last year.
Wow.
Things are just crazy now.
Yeah. Eric, thank you for the phone call. All right. Butterflies. You recently took part in some butterfly counts and found some interesting, you're finding some interesting things as we speak here in your mother-in-law's yard.
Yes. I don't see giant swallowtails very often. I think they're not that common on the Cape. They're common. They kind of came up the Connecticut River Valley first. I more likely see them on the North Shore. I think there are some native host plants that are in this citrus family. But anyway, it's huge. I mean, it's bigger than even a tiger swallowtail, which is our biggest. I mean, not like noticeably bigger, but they can be bigger than tiger swallowtail. So it's a gigantic butterfly, black with these kind of yellow crosses on them. But yes, but in terms of the butterfly counts, butterflies are great. And there's this organization called the North American Butterfly Association, NABBA. And they sponsor these 4th of July butterfly counts, they call them. And they're just like the Christmas bird counts in terms of the scope and the goal, right? It's citizen science. It's getting people out there to cover an area, 15-mile circle on one particular day, and then send in the results. And it creates a long-term data set that gives some insights into what's happening with populations. And so there's a Falmouth one that I never am able to do it, but it's not really Falmouth. It's just Crane Wildlife Management Area, which is an absolute wonderland of butterflies. You look at the way that habitat has been changed by active management by the state. It's like 400 acres of butterfly weed and black-eyed Susan. It's incredible. I marvel whenever I go to Crane. Oh, I just heard a pileated woodpecker behind me somewhere. And so there's that count. There's a Brewster count, it's called, that starts at the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History and goes out as far as Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary, which I cover. And then there's a churro count where we go to various places in Truro. And it's just a lot of fun. You know, it's just people who are into butterflies getting out and checking the same places year after year, looking for, you know, can we find the Edwards hair streaks again? Did we miss the bog coppers and the wild cranberry bog? And it just, it gets you into cool places where you might find interesting plants. You might find some interesting birds too, though the focus is on the butterflies. And we end up out at Hatches Harbor, all those wetlands out there and the wild cranberry bogs, looking for bog coppers and other interesting things, striped hair streaks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just one of these things where people don't really pay much attention to them. But if they did, if they took some time, if somebody showed them, you know, join a walk, there's the Mass Butterfly Club. They don't do much on the Cape, but they do more walks off Cape, particularly in Plymouth. But check out the Mass Butterfly Club website. They have the dates of the counts and walks and things like that, and resources, species accounts for every species of butterfly in the state. But I guess the first advice would be just focus your search image at something smaller than a monarch. Like, okay, start with monarchs. Everybody knows monarchs, mm-hmm. tiger swallowtails. You can see those. But the average butterfly is a fraction of that size, right? Little pearl crescents and American coppers are tiny, and they're the most abundant ones. And so you might be missing those. And then maybe don't start with skippers, because they're like worse than sandpipers and sparrows.
Oh boy.
But there aren't that many of them, and they're around. Oh, the pileated just landed right here.
Oh my goodness. See what happens when you get outside to do your show.
I love this yard. They have kind of a wetland, and there's a stream, and there's big dead trees, and it's just right there. I'm gonna go get my camera. Show's over.
Okay, no, it's not. We only have about a minute left. Right. You can wait a minute. And Jennifer in Falmouth says she's been hearing saw-whet owls for the past two nights. What are they up to this time of year?
Wow. Same as, you know, they'd be done breeding. I don't know why one would be calling. That's cool. Get a recording of that. Mm-hmm. They do breed on the Cape. It was always considered the like southernmost place on the Atlantic coast that they nest. And they certainly do nest here. I don't ever come across them, but you'd have to kind of go looking for them and listening for them in certain places. Marconi White Cedar Swamp has always been a classic place. Ooh, did you hear that?
What is it?
The pileated probably didn't make it into the microphone because of the headphones, but it just called very loudly. Oh. So, yeah, they'd be in that post-breeding period. It could be a young one. I don't know how early the young ones can call. Like great horned owls, the young ones can't hoot for the whole entire first year. Mm. But that's just a very cool sighting. You don't hear of many saw-whet owl reports, particularly this time of year.
So exciting. All right, Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. All right, Mark, go get the camera. Run out. Go get those pictures.
Thanks, Mindy.
Thanks for being with us.
All right.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.